All right, so today I'm going to talk about a certain somewhat odd interpretation of quantum mechanics. Not because I think it's the best interpretation of quantum mechanics, that it solves all the problems, that the other ones don't work. I just think it's an interesting alternative to have on the table. I think it has some virtues, I think it has some challenges. So I want to get it out there. Good. So before I start, let me acknowledge another group working on similar projects. So when I submitted this to a conference, in February, I found out that there was another group working on a very similar idea. I've been in correspondence with them and I've talked to them about the idea. And if you're interested in it, you should keep an eye out for their paper in addition to mine, if you like the idea. All right, so what kind of interpretation is this going to be? I'm going to give you some spoilers now so you know what to expect, so it doesn't just all come out of nowhere. So I'll give you some idea as to what to expect today. So first of all the theories I'm going to be talking about today are deterministic theories. There's no collapse in any of these theories. There's no stochastic laws. Good. The one I'm going to be giving today is a sort of blend between Bohmian mechanics and the Everett interpretation, the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. It has some features from each. It has some unique features. One of the interesting things is that you get rid of the wave function. The wave function is not part of the fundamental ontology. Of course, we're still going to be able to talk about wave functions. They're really integral to the way we do quantum mechanics, so I'm not going to get rid of the wave function entirely, but it won't be part of the fundamental story. It'll be a way of describing the fundamental entities. And because there's no wave function, the Schrodinger equation is not going to be one of the fundamental laws of the theory. It's going to be a many worlds theory, sorry, unfortunately. But the worlds aren't going to be emergent entities coming up from the wave function. There will be a finite collection of worlds, a large number of worlds, and the worlds don't branch or split or come into existence or leave existence. There's just a certain number of them and they stay there. Good. In each of these worlds, particles will follow Bohmian trajectories. As I mentioned, the wave function is not part of the fundamental ontology, but you can still introduce a wave function. With that introduced wave function, relative to that introduced wave function, in each world, the particles will appear to follow Bohmian trajectories. This is a nice feature of the theory because Bohmian mechanics works really well, and this is able to latch on to some of that success. The reason why I'm calling this quantum mechanics as classical physics, which might sound sort of like I'm looking for trouble, is that the single equation of motion for the theory is an F equals ma type equation. So there's a Newtonian force law that drives the dynamics of the theory. So we'll get there. This theory is not unprecedented. I think it's, I haven't seen anything that's just like it, but it's in the family of quantum hydrodynamics approaches to quantum mechanics. And these were started by Erwin Matelong back in the 1920s. Good. So, outline for today. start with some familiar interpretations of quantum mechanics, some familiar solutions to the measurement problem, the many worlds interpretation in Bohmian mechanics. Then I'm going to introduce one that you're probably not going to love. I don't like it. It's weird. It takes too much stuff on board. It's a sort of a ontologically extravagant theory, which I'm calling prodigal QM. But it's useful as a stepping stone. It helps us to get to the theory that I do want to talk about, which is what I'm calling Newtonian quantum mechanics. Then I'm going to talk about two virtues of the theory, two things that I like about the theory. The first is the way it handles probability, and the second is the way it handles time reversal. It also handles Galilean boosts well, but I'm not going to talk about that in the talk. And then an account of a weakness of the theory, which is non-quantum states. So the state space for the theory is actually larger than you'd like. So there are some allowed states by this theory that work well, they reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics. There are extra states that don't do that. So you have to limit, you have to put some constraint to limit the state space for the theory if you want just the old states that you had in quantum mechanics. So I'll talk about that a bit. Good. So working in the foundations of quantum mechanics, we have a bit of a puzzle with the word world. It sort of serves two purposes. On the one hand, you want to talk about everything as the world. On the other hand, you want to talk about the many worlds of quantum mechanics as separate worlds. So I'm going to try to institute a regimen of the way I use language here, and I may not be entirely successful, but I'll make an effort to reserve world for the many worlds of quantum mechanics. Those are separate worlds, and use universe for the entire multiverse, for everything, what philosophers call the actual world. So this entirety of reality, that's the universe, and these separate worlds that become isolated from each other, those are worlds. Good. All right, so let's start with something very familiar. Just start with the double slit experiment. So what I want you to understand is this contour plot in the bottom right. If it makes sense to you already, great. Let me just get there quickly from the other graphs. So if you start with the top two, those show in time the evolution of the wave function. The upper left shows the real and imaginary parts of the wave function. The upper right shows the amplitude squared of the wave function. The amplitude squared starts peaked at the two slits, and then the interference pattern emerges over time. That can be shown as a three-dimensional plot here, where psi squared is this axis and time goes up here. We can squash that three-dimensional plot to get a contour plot, where at the initial time, the wave function is located at the two slits. As you go on, you get an interference pattern. So this is psi squared plotted over time, one dimension. OK, so the first familiar interpretation of quantum mechanics. So I'm calling these solutions because I see them as solutions to the measurement problem. These are ways of filling in the details of quantum mechanics. Now, I'm not going to review the measurement problem here. I'm not really going to discuss it. I'm going to jump into ideas people have had about how to solve it. But very roughly, the measurement problem is just that we don't have a consensus. We don't have a clear view as to what the fundamental stuff is in quantum mechanics. How do you represent the state of the world? What things do you include or not include in that? And how does that stuff evolve? What are the dynamical laws for the theory? So the task that I see all of these theories as engaged in is trying to give a fundamental story to accompany non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Now, of course, it'd be interesting to account for relativistic quantum mechanics as well. I might talk about that a little bit later. Today, to limit my focus, I'm going to be talking entirely about non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and I'm not going to get into spin. So it'd be spin zero bosons, non-relativistic. Good. So there's a project to try to come up with a fundamental story of what's happening in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. If non-relativistic quantum mechanics was the right story of what's going on in reality, what would that story be? Or what options are there if there are more than one story that works? Good. So one solution is the many worlds interpretation. This is also called the Everett interpretation or Everettian quantum mechanics. Good. According to the many worlds interpretation, all there is a wave function. People, planets, everyday objects are patterns in that wave function. That wave function always evolves unitarily. It doesn't collapse. It always evolves in accordance with the Schrodinger equation. So looking at it this way, the theory is quite simple. All there is a wave function. All it does is obey the Schrodinger equation. So there's this nice seductive way of putting the many worlds interpretation. Now, there's trouble. Of course, there are well-known problems for the many worlds interpretation beyond just the fact that it is a many worlds interpretation, which some don't like. But this is the basic statement of it. And what's supposed to happen in the many worlds interpretation is if you make a measurement, if Alice measures the spin of a particle and it could be up or down, there'll be a copy of Alice that sees up, there'll be a copy that sees down. These copies, because of decoherence, will be causally isolated from each other. Good, so that's the basic story about measurements. All outcomes of measurements actually happen, and they happen in causally isolated worlds. Good. All right, so the next familiar solution is Bohmian mechanics. And I hope that Everettian quantum mechanics and Bohmian quantum mechanics are fairly familiar to you, as I'm not giving a long story about how they work. Good, so according to Bohmian mechanics, there's still a wave function. The wave function still obeys the Schrodinger equation. That part doesn't change. Now, let me make another clarification here. The way I formulated many worlds interpretation before and the way I'm formulating Bohmian mechanics here, the sort of ardent supporters of those theories might take issue with me. They might say, no, that's not exactly what we want to say the ontology is. No, those aren't quite the right way. That's not quite the right way of formulating the theory. The version of many worlds interpretation I gave is what sometimes is called a wave function realist approach. I just say, yeah, the wave function's there. It's a real part of reality. That's what there is. It evolves by the Schrodinger equation. There are more subtle accounts. Here, for Bohmian mechanics, I'm saying there's a wave function and there's particles. But sometimes people want to say that the wave function is somehow not as real or not as important or not to be taken as seriously as the particles, and they develop some subtle account about how that's supposed to go. Here I'm giving the non-subtle simple version, just so that we can use these as jumping off points to start looking at new theories. So in the non-subtle simple version, Bohmian mechanics looks at this puzzle, this old puzzle, of wave-particle duality. How can the electron sometimes behave like a wave, sometimes behave like a particle, and says, look, there's both. There's a wave. The wave function's real. It's part of reality. It goes around and does its Schrodinger equation thing all the time. There are also particles. And particles just have definite positions. They act like particles you would expect particles to act. They don't occupy two points at once. They follow well-defined trajectories. And there's a law. There's a new law introduced, this Bohmian guidance equation, that tells you what the particles do in response to the moving wave function. So it specifies the velocity of the kth particle here in terms of the wave function and the mass of the kth particle. So it says, look, fixing the wave function, and you tell me where all the particles are, this equation tells me where they're going to go, how they move in response to that motion of the wave function. So the wave function guides the particles along. Good. And so the double slit experiment in the first case in the many worlds interpretation was just a wave function. That's all there was happening, was a wave function. Now here we've added that there's actually a particle. This particle starts at the lower part of the top slit and moves into the center band of the interference pattern as it goes. Good. Okay, now something weird, something new. Prodigal QM is what I'm calling it, because it's ontologically extravagant. It has more stuff than you would want. It's a lot like Bohmian mechanics in that, all right, so here's how I think you should think about it. So in Bohmian mechanics, what you have is a wave function which assigns a complex number to each point in configuration space. So if you're sort of staring at configuration space, you've got complex number, a complex valued field over configuration space. Then you've got one point in configuration space that's special. That represents the actual configuration of particles. None of the other configuration of particles really occur anywhere, just that one actual one. And that point in configuration space gets pushed around by the wave function. What prodigal QM says is just add more special points in configuration space. Keep peppering configuration space with points that are special. Now it's become a many worlds theory because there's many special points in configuration space. But don't just pepper them at random. Put more where psi squared is large. Put less where psi squared is small. So pepper them in proportion to the amplitude squared of the wave function. So now we have a lot of worlds where the amplitude of the wave function is high, very few worlds where the amplitude is small, but some. Good. Now each of these worlds is pushed around by the same wave function and pushed around by pretty much the Bohmian guidance equation. So they're pushed around in the same way they would be if those other worlds weren't around. Now the initial thing you should think right now is, God, why have those extra worlds, right? I'm only in one, I only ever see one world, and the way my world is pushed around is determined entirely by the wave function. So who needs these extra worlds? And that's a great reaction to have. So it's, I think Bohmian mechanics is superior to this theory, pretty much. I think that you do get a large gain in simplicity and maybe other virtues by getting rid of all the worlds and just having one and having Bohmian mechanics. The reason that I introduced this theory is because that's not the only way to simplify it. So what's going to be interesting is that that strategy gets rid of all the worlds but one, and that does make it a simpler theory. Another way to simplify the theory is to get rid of the wave function and keep the worlds. So that's the strategy that's going to be taken by Newtonian QM. Get rid of the wave function, keep this ensemble of worlds. Okay, so switching between the last slide and this one, what's changed when we move to prodigal QM from Bohmian mechanics? Well, the first thing you should notice is the particles are represented differently. The particles are now represented by rho and vk instead of positions and velocities for each particle. Rho is a density of worlds on configuration space. I'll talk about it a little more in the next slide. And vk is a set of velocity fields on configuration space, one for each particle. So k is an index over particles. Also, the guidance equation changes just slightly. The right-hand side is the same, but now it has to guide all the different velocities for all the particles in all the worlds, not just the velocities of the actual particles in our world. Good. OK, so what's going on with these rho and v things that's important? Yeah. Sure. OK. good. So this world density rho and these velocity fields vk, what's going on here? So let me just explain those a bit, because I want those to make sense. Rho gives the density of worlds in configuration space, you know, how many worlds are in a given region of configuration space. And it's scaled so that if you integrate it over all of configuration space, you get one. It's normalized. So if you integrate it over a region of configuration space that's not all of configuration space, you get the fraction of worlds that live in that region of configuration space. By hypothesis, rho is equal to psi squared. So I was saying the way we pepper these worlds, the way we add worlds into the theory, you put more where psi squared is high, less where psi squared is low. This is the mathematical way of representing that. This velocity vector field takes a point in configuration space and spits out the velocity for the kth particle. So it says, look, go to that point in configuration space. What velocities does the kth particle have in that world? And that's what vk is. Good. If you know all the velocities of all the particles in all the worlds, and you know how many worlds are in what different parts of configuration space, you should be able to see how that density in configuration space changes over time, that's given by this continuity equation. So as the particles in the worlds move around, the worlds move around in configuration space and the density changes, and that's represented here. Now, this is all meant to closely parallel hydrodynamics, to closely parallel fluid mechanics. So let me just draw that out a little bit. So the parallel on the left side, I guess your right side of the slide here, rho is used for the density of the fluid. So if we have a compressible fluid, it might be more dense in certain areas, less dense in other areas. It takes in a point in three-dimensional space, a point inside your pipe or container or wherever the fluid is, and it spits out a density for the fluid there, and that can change in time. Similarly, you can have a velocity field, gives you the velocity of particles in a certain part of your fluid at a certain point in space. And you have a continuity equation for the fluid that says how the density changes as the particles move around. Good. okay. So the density of worlds evolves by this continuity equation. How do the velocities evolve in time? How do these particles move about? Well, as I said before, that's determined by the guidance equation. So there's still a guidance equation in prodigal QM, and that determines how the velocities of the particles move. But what's interesting is that you can represent the way the velocities of the particles change in a way that doesn't reference the wave function. And that's, you know, a small derivation to get to, but I'll say what it takes in and what it spits out. What it spits out is this equation at the bottom, giving you the accelerations of the particles in terms of things that don't include the wave function in the theory. So in terms of the potential V and the density of worlds rho, but not referencing psi at all. So you start with these three features of prodigal QM. So the top one, worlds are distributed in accordance with psi squared. That was by hypothesis. That's how these worlds were peppered into the wave function. The Schrodinger equation, right? The wave function obeys the Schrodinger equation. Here I have a particular Hamiltonian, and throughout the slides I will assume this kind of a Hamiltonian. It's fairly general. It allows for interactions between particles. It allows for an external potential. But, you know, there's something given there. It's not just an arbitrary Hamiltonian. Then the guidance equation that says how the particles move around in response to this wave function. From these, you can derive this equation for the acceleration of the particles in the different worlds. Now here I've gotten rid of the arguments. So I've been writing these arguments over and over again, these arguments that take in a point in configuration space and a time, this x1, x2, x3, et cetera, and a time. Here I've gotten rid of those. But the acceleration, the density, and the potential v, they all depend on the point in configuration space and the time. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Good. So there's an intimate relation between the phase of the wave function and the velocities of particles. So if you change the phase of the wave function, you will change the velocities of particles, but you won't actually change their accelerations. So it's encoded in the velocities, but not the acceleration. Yes, as in Bohmian mechanics. So that's true for prodigal QM. Because this guidance equation is a fundamental equation of the theory. So there's a fundamental first order time derivative of the positions that's specified by the theory. So if you give me the positions and you give me the wave function, you can't freely specify the velocities anymore because this equation's obeyed. It would not be fair at all at this stage. So this is prodigal QM. We haven't moved on to Newtonian QM yet. So the wave function is still present in prodigal QM, and that's why I think it's a excessive theory. But we're almost at the point where we're going to move to one without the wave function. And this equation is the key to doing so. Because in this equation here, this is a derivative equation, a non-fundamental equation in prodigal QM. So it's derived from the Schrodinger equation, the guidance equation, the equations that govern the time evolution of the state in prodigal QM. You get this equation for the accelerations of particles. But this equation that you get is really suggestive. It looks really cool because it's ma on one side, mass times acceleration. On the other side, you have the gradient of a potential that involves the normal potential that you would have, v. If it weren't for this big mess here, if it weren't for this term, the particles would just be following classical trajectories with that external potential. And then there's this sort of quantum potential term, q, which is very similar to the quantum potential in Bohmian mechanics. Although this shouldn't be confused with a similar equation that you can get in Bohmian mechanics, which, although mathematically similar looking, doesn't involve a density of worlds and doesn't involve velocity fields over configuration space. But yeah, you have something like the old quantum potential from Bohmian mechanics. Good. So once you see that this equation has this non-fundamental status in prodigal QM, it's worth thinking, well, wait, can we take that to be a fundamental equation of motion for the theory? If we take that to be a fundamental equation for of motion for the theory, what happens? So that's what Newtonian quantum mechanics does. It says this is the fundamental equation of motion for the theory. What there is a density of worlds and these velocity fields. So what there are particles in many different worlds whizzing about with their velocities. And the wave function is excised from the theory. Good. I will get to that. It's a good question. Ideally, it would be nice if it were just give me any and things will work out. There would be some corresponding wave function and everything would be hunky-dory. In fact, there is a constraint that you need to impose. It's a constraint on the velocities, not a constraint on the densities. But we'll get there. It's actually near the end, so sit on it for a while. But I do see that as one of the more significant downsides to this theory, and I think that's important. Good. Okay, so now if we take this Newtonian force law to be one of the fundamental laws of our theory, and we hang on to these particles in many different worlds, we get what I think is a very interesting theory, one that I think has some significant strengths as an interpretation of quantum mechanics, or as a sort of solution to the measurement problem. Good. And if you look at what's happening in the double slit experiment here, going back to prodigal QM, there were a whole bunch of Bohmian paths. There were a whole bunch of particles following Bohmian trajectories through the double slit experiment. When we move to Newtonian QM, there's just the particles following these paths. There's no wave function guiding them behind it. In the prodigal QM theory, the worlds were not interacting with each other. These different particles weren't interacting with each other. They were all just being pushed by the wave function. The wave function was doing all of the pushing. The particles, the different worlds, didn't care about the other worlds. Each world alone was following its own path guided by the wave function. In Newtonian quantum mechanics, this term in the force law here is an interaction between worlds. The worlds do push each other around. So what's happening when you see them sort of hit here in the middle and push off each other, that's a real just F equals ma Newtonian force between worlds that's pushing them apart. Good. So to summarize, so far, there's ever-ready in quantum mechanics. All there is the wave function. Bohmian mechanics adds particles with definite trajectories. Prodigal QM adds a lot of particles with definite trajectories organized into these different worlds. And Newtonian QM keeps the collection of worlds following the same trajectories, but gets rid of the wave function. Good. OK, gets rid of the wave function. But wait, the wave function was a really important part of quantum mechanics. What's happened here? Well, the wave function's not part of the fundamental ontology on Newtonian quantum mechanics. It's not there in the laws. But we can still define one up in terms of the fundamental ontology. We can use it as a way to describe what's going on in the fundamental ontology, provided it satisfies two conditions. So the magnitude of the wave function is generated by looking at the density of worlds. So we move from the density of worlds rho to psi squared. So we get the amplitude of the wave function from the density of worlds. And the phase of the wave function is going to give you the velocities of the worlds. So you've got to choose a phase of the wave function that varies in the right way that this guidance equation is satisfied. So from the positions and velocities of worlds, you can generate a wave function. Good. So that'll be useful to have on the table, because sometimes we want to talk about the wave function. All right, so now on to probability. Yeah, question. Yeah, good question. So if you eliminate the wave function, you would still want to have some equation, something like this in Bohmian mechanics. I mean, you wouldn't want to say that there's accelerations for all the particles in all the worlds, but you'd say there's accelerations for the particles in the one world. But you'd have something like this left over. Now, in the Bohmian equation, it's the absolute value of psi. It's the amplitude of psi instead of the square root of the density. What are you going to replace that with? That's the real problem that comes up. And wave function is left in there because it's needed to generate the dynamics. If you get rid of the wave function, you need to have something else to sort of keep that information and tell you about the dynamics. The ensemble of worlds plays that role here. It keeps the information about the amplitude of the wave function in its density. It keeps the information about the phase of the wave function in its velocities, the velocities of the different worlds. You could try other methods, but that's the general problem that comes up. Good. Okay, so probability is largely regarded as the main problem for the Everett interpretation of quantum mechanics. Many people think that it doesn't satisfactorily handle probability. Now, there are some attempts to do so, and they may ultimately be successful, but there's at least a prima facie problem for probability in Everett that I'm going to argue doesn't show up in this new theory. So let me get the prima facie problem on the table. So first, there's a sort of incoherence problem for probabilities in Everett. So the incoherence problem is that, look, how can you assign probabilities to future events when you know what's going to happen? So imagine you're doing a spin measurement. It could be up. It could be down. You know the wave function initially, or sort of all the stuff that's relevant about it. So you know there's going to be a copy of you when you're done with your experiment who sees up. There'll be another copy that sees down. Before the experiment, if you assign probabilities to seeing up and you assign probabilities to seeing down, what are you assigning probabilities to? There's going to be a version of you that sees up, so it can't be a probability that somebody's going to see up. You want to say something like, it's a probability that I'm going to see up, but it's hard to see what that could possibly mean. I mean, there's a version of you that sees up, there's a version that doesn't. They're both connected to you. Maybe one of them is more connected to you, but that's already determined ahead of time. Because it's deterministic like that, there aren't probabilities in the fundamental laws like there are in G of W. And because there's nothing that you're ignorant about, or we can assume that you know as much as is needed is about the wave function, there's no probabilities in ignorance, it's hard to understand what the probabilities in Everett are probabilities of. I think that's a significant problem for the theory. But even if that's solved somehow, even if we can make sense of the probabilities being probabilities of something, there's still a quantitative probability problem for Everett. Why are those probabilities given by the Born rule? I mean, if everything happens, then isn't everything as likely to happen? Or what does it mean to say something has a certain probability at all? How can we assign these numbers? How can we assign the right numbers? Okay, so here's a way of seeing the problem about assigning the right numbers. Here's a reason why you might think the most natural numbers to assign are not the right numbers. So imagine that you've got, initially, the particle has this wave function, square root 9/10 up in the z direction, square root 1/10 down in the z direction, right? This is a very familiar, simple state. Textbook quantum mechanics would say it has a 90% chance of being spin up if you measure it, a 10% chance of being spin down. If you measure 10 particles like this, you should expect to see 9 up and 1 down. At least that's the most likely outcome. It actually doesn't happen more than 50% of the time. It happens about 40% of the time. But that's the most likely thing to see. But in this case, if you idealize and you say there's one branch on which each sequence of outcome occurs, there's got to be at least one branch on which each sequence occurs. If there's one branch on which each sequence occurs, then there's 1,024 branches after 10 measurements. If you measure 10 particles initially prepared like that, there's 1,024 different sequences of up and down you can see, you know, where the order counts. In 250 of these, about 250 of these, if Alice does this experiment, she's going to see 5 up and 5 down. So that's pretty common out of the space of possibilities. That's, in fact, the most common out of these 1,024 things that could happen. In only 10 of these branches, 1% of them, about 1% of them, she's going to see 9 up and 1 down. But this should be the most likely thing to happen. And it's very unlikely if we just count the number of copies of Alice. Yeah, right, Jess. And that's even worse, right?
Well, in that case, you have no counting norm.
Yeah.
So unless you're prepared to a priori throw out the possibility of multiple outcomes, you have to pick some norm on continuous.
Good. I mean, this strategy, it works very poorly. generally, the strategy of counting branches. So not only does it get you the wrong results, which you might think is more of an indictment of Everett than an indictment of the strategy, because why should we expect Everett to give the right outcomes? This is just some positing of the fundamental laws. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. So I think one initial reaction you can have is, oh, so Everett's wrong, not the counting norm. But one thing that does push you to say that this counting strategy is wrong is that it doesn't apply in many cases. In many cases, sort of what counting results you get depends on how you coarse grain and things like that. So it really doesn't work well. But I think it's useful in illustrating a prima facie problem for Everett. Just the fact that there is a probability problem, a quantitative probability problem. Because look, this one natural way of doing it doesn't work. We've got to explain why that's the wrong way to do it and why you should care about psi squared at all when you're trying to get the probabilities. So just to get the problem on the board. Newtonian quantum mechanics doesn't suffer a similar problem. And the reason's pretty simple. So the wave function's defined up from the density of worlds. It's defined up from the density of worlds in such a way that rho equals psi squared by definition of psi, by definition of the way we introduce psi from the fundamental ontology. So it's always going to be the case that the vast majority of worlds are in regions where psi squared is non-negligible. And where psi squared is large, there'll be more worlds. So when these branches separate and 40% of psi squared is over here and 60% is over there, 60% of the worlds will be here, and 40% of the worlds will be there. So the proportion of worlds in any region is always going to match with psi squared. And in the long run, when you do lots of experiments, the worlds in which the frequencies of different outcomes in those experiments match the Born rule statistics, the sort of psi square measured applied to all those worlds is going to be very high. Most of the worlds will be like that. There'll be very few worlds in which you see anomalous statistics in the long run. I'm not saying the infinitely long run here, just the very long run. And so on this theory, the vast majority of worlds that you might find yourself in are going to see Born rule statistics in the long run. There are a few that see anomalous statistics, but not many. Good. What kind of uncertainty is there present here? Well, you're just ignorant about which world you're in. There's a self-locating uncertainty. So before the double slit experiment, there were a bunch of worlds where the particle was in the top slit and a bunch of worlds where it went through the bottom slit. And before you look, you don't know which one it was. If you see it hit in one of the lower bounds of the interference pattern, you can learn, oh, the one in my world, the particle in my world, was in the lower slit. So you can sort of infer back to what it was doing. Yeah, question.
So this would imply that when you carry out
Yeah, good. I mean, I don't think that would be all you learn. So the kind of case I'm thinking about now is cases where you suppose that sort of the state of the universe is known. You still don't know what outcome you're going to see from the experiment. So even if you know the density of worlds, you know, the velocities of the particles in all the worlds, there's still something to be learned in the measurement, namely where you are, which is not something, yeah, which is a self-locating fact. It's not a fact about what the universe as a whole is like. It's a fact about where you are in it. Yeah. So the idea that you can't learn what world you're in from self-locating information is controversial and sort of depends on the details. But let me just say another thing to clarify. The assumption that you know the density of worlds and their velocities is completely unrealistic. So in the same way that in the normal case of measurements, you learn something about the wave function often, or there are many kinds of experiments you can do where you learn about the wave function, here too there are many experiments you can do where you learn about the kind of world you're in. So when you do a spin measurement on a known initial state, yes, you don't learn anything much about, you know, what the universe is like, but you learn what world you're in. If you do other sorts of experiments, like on an unknown initial wave function, then you would be learning about the universe.
But yeah. Given that, if not everything, a large amount of, you know, the evidence for at least mostly has a quantum mechanics is on the few words turn out to self-looking information, are we still going to have enough evidence to say that quantum mechanics as a theory is inherently different?
Why not? Sorry. Yeah, so maybe I have to take more of a stance on what I was saying before, which is that I think you can learn about the world through that kind of information. So on this kind of theory, it's going to say, look, there's very few worlds in which, in a given universe, there's very few worlds in which you see anomalous non-Born rule statistics. If in fact you go out and see non-Born rule statistics, you've seen something that doesn't agree well with this theory, that the theory didn't predict. If you do see Born-Rule statistics, you see something the theory did predict. I think that can legitimately confirm or disconfirm this theory relative to other theories like GRW, Bohmian mechanics, many worlds, classical physics, you know, alternative theories. I do think that. But maybe we could talk about it more afterwards. I think it's interesting question. Good. And I think that, you know, though, if you know the state of the universe, if you know the density of worlds, and you know the velocities of particles in the various worlds, you should be uncertain as to which world you're in. You shouldn't prefer one world to another, specifying a given universe. Conditional that you're in a given universe, you should assign equal credence to all the worlds consistent with your evidence. That's a somewhat controversial thesis, but I think that's integral to the story here. Good. Okay, so what about Bohmian mechanics? what does Bohmian mechanics say about probability? Well, before we get into probability, let me say one thing about the connection between Newtonian quantum mechanics and Bohmian mechanics, which I sort of mentioned before. In Newtonian quantum mechanics, every world follows a Bohmian trajectory through configuration space. So if you liked Bohmian mechanics, if you thought worlds following these trajectories through configuration space can reproduce the statistics we see, can reproduce our experiences of the quantum world, the semi-classical world that emerges from quantum mechanics, whatever, Newtonian quantum mechanics can do so as well. Each world is following the same kind of path. So if you like those paths, this is a nice thing, and it explains the way Newtonian quantum mechanics handles a lot of puzzles, because it can just piggyback on Bohmian mechanics. They're doing the same kind of paths that they would have done in Bohmian mechanics. Some Bohmian trajectories do not reproduce quantum statistics. It's not absolutely guaranteed. So you need to specify the initial wave function, and you need to specify the initial configuration of particles. If those aren't in harmony in the right way, you won't get the right statistics when you do experiments, at least not initially. If you want to see the right long-term statistics, your state of the universe, the specification of the wave function and the initial configuration of particles, has to be in quantum equilibrium. So that's a certain, as I was saying, certain harmony between the wave function and the configuration. Now, why should we expect to be in one that is in quantum equilibrium? If you think Bohmian mechanics reproduces the right statistics on observations, you think we are in quantum equilibrium, at least now. So why should we expect to be? What story can they tell? Well, some Bohmians, maybe not many, but a few, regard it as a sort of postulate of the theory. So it's an additional assumption that the quantum equilibrium hypothesis is true. It's another part of the theory. Another option is to say that the vast majority of states are like that, that it's typical to be in a state that's in quantum equilibrium. That's just the normal thing. We shouldn't expect anything different. That's an option. It relies on a certain measure of how we measure the vast majority of states, and that's controversial. The last option that I'll mention is we can say that, look, there are some states that are not in quantum equilibrium, but they come to quantum equilibrium very quickly. We can give a sort of dynamical explanation that quantum equilibrium gets reached. So even if the world might not have started in quantum equilibrium, we should expect it to be in quantum equilibrium by now. It's surely been around for a while. So anyway, there are stories like that, but people can forget that Bohmian mechanics does have issues with probability. In the end, they might be solvable. Most people seem to think they are. I probably think they are in the end. But you do need something of a story as to why we should expect to be in one of these worlds that's in quantum equilibrium. In Newtonian quantum mechanics, it's also possible that one's own world fails to exhibit quantum statistics in the long run. But it's not possible for the majority of worlds to do that. So it's always going to be the case that in any universe, in any specification of all the worlds, the vast majority of the worlds see quantum statistics in the long run. Good. And this really, again, just follows from the fact that wherever psi squared is large, the vast majority of the worlds are there. And when you do lots of measurements, psi squared becomes small for the anomalous statistics and high for the normal statistics, the statistics that are in agreement with the Born rule. OK. OK, so let's look at time reversal now. This is another thing that I'm going to tout as a virtue of the theory. So in Time and Chance, David Albert proposed a definition of time reversal invariance in which the wave function psi of t should go to psi of minus t under time reversal. That's what time reversal is, just things happening in the opposite order. If you use that time reversal transformation, quantum mechanics doesn't turn out to be time reversal invariant. Psi of t can satisfy the Schrodinger equation when psi of minus t fails to. People tend to think quantum mechanics is time reversal invariant. They think that the wave function goes to psi star of minus t under the time reversal operation. Whether or not you agree with Albert's account of time reversal, There's a sort of puzzle here as to why the wave function should go to psi star of minus t under time reversal instead of psi of minus t. How can we explain the complex conjugation of the wave function under time reversal? Well, it's really easy to time reverse particle trajectories. The positions just get passed through in the opposite order, and the velocities flip if you do time reversal on the trajectories. So the fundamental ontology of Newtonian quantum mechanics, it's easy to time reverse. Rho of t goes to rho of minus t. The densities happen in the opposite order, and all the velocities get flipped. It turns out, and we can talk about this more in Q&A if you want, but it turns out that if psi of t, a wave function correctly describes an initial history, if you flip all the, if you flip the order at which the densities are passed through, or you flip the velocities, then psi star of minus t is going to describe the time reversal of that history. So Newtonian quantum mechanics is capable of, the way I would put it is Newtonian quantum mechanics is capable of explaining the way the wave function transforms under time reversal. Yeah.
So I want to just say that what you've really used there is your classical intuition that you put that minus sign in front of the velocities, right? But kind of a priori, I'm just thinking about math.
Yeah. Good. So I would put it a little differently, just giving a little more of the detail of this Albert story that I was giving, so which I didn't explain before. So what happens on the Albert story is you have a sequence of instantaneous states of the universe. What makes something an instantaneous state of the universe? Well, you can specify it sort of independently of the next state. It's not dependent on the next state for its explanation. If you reorder all these instantaneous states of the universe, you get a different history. If that new history also obeys the laws, the theory is time reversal invariant. Now, for particles moving, what do you do for the instantaneous state? According to Albert, you should give the positions, but not the velocities of particles, because velocities depend on a connection between states on how the positions are changing. So what you should do when you do time reversal of particle trajectories is flip the positions, and that will lead to a flipping of the velocity, sorry, flip the order of the positions, that will lead to a negative sign on the velocities, but you're not fundamentally flipping the velocities and deciding that that should have a minus sign. It's because you flip the positions first and then generate the velocities from them that you get the minus sign, if that makes sense. And he thinks that the wave function, if the wave function is part of your instantaneous state, if your wave function is the kind of thing that you can specify at each time, if you flip the order of the wave function, there's no obvious reason why you should complex conjugate it. But we can talk about it more later, too. It's a good question. Yeah, Rob. Yeah. I don't think it's intended to, because I don't think it's intended to work that way, because it's proposed for sort of classical mechanics, just Newtonian forces, Newtonian gravity, things like that, to have this kind of account.
See, I think in classical mechanics, yeah. You have the Lagrangian formulation or the Newtonian formulation.
Yeah.
So in the Lagrangian formulation, this picture would make sense, like just the kinematics position, and I look at different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I do have to make a commitment on, how should momentum change?
Yeah. Maybe it's good to clarify two questions here. So one is, how much do I need to specify on a time slice to get all the future evolution? And it's true, to get all the future evolution in a theory that works with these kind of second order laws, I've got to specify the positions and the velocities at a time if I want to get the future evolution. There's another question of sort of, can the velocities be specified independently at each time in the same way that the positions can. That's supposed to be more like, that's supposed to have more to do with the relation of velocity to position than anything about the dynamics. And the idea is just that, look, I can't say that the velocity was, 1 meter per second forward and then minus 2 meters per second and then 3 meters per second. I can't specify it independently of the positions. Like, once I've specified all the positions over time, I've specified the velocities. There's nothing extra to add. That's the sense that's important here, is that on each time slice you give the positions, and once you've done that, you've given the velocities. There's no extra thing to specify to give the velocities. Does that make sense? Because of that definitional, just because of the fact that v equals dx dt, which I guess you could think of as an extra law. Okay. That's the idea. But anyway, this is all part of Albert's account. I'm not saying that you have to buy Albert's account of time reversal. In the end, it's fine if you don't. The real key point, as I said before, is that the complex conjugation might have seemed weird. This explains it. Even better, and not in part of the presentation, is the way the wave function transforms under Galilean boosts, which is quite weird. It's not just complex conjugation. You get a whole messy phase factor introduced. You might say, why do you get that phase factor? Well, here, if you boost all the particles in all the worlds and then you get a new wave function from it, that's the one you get. So it sort of explains that.
Yeah.
So none of this is relativistic or field theory.
Right,
that's the first pass answer. Yeah.
Doing non-relativistic quantum mechanics and you have to add this weird phase to the wave function. I thought that was nicely solved. Or at least I remember thinking about it a few years ago. It's nicely solved when you do field theory.
I'd have to talk to you about that more later. I guess I don't know that off the top of my head what to say about that. But
yeah.
Good question. Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, so how many worlds? So all along we've been talking about a sort of continuum limit. I've been talking about things in terms of a density rho and a velocity fields v, and then I was saying, like, by the way, there's just a finite number of worlds, right? So admittedly, that's not ideal. It would be nice if I had laws that would tell me what a handful of worlds would do, what two or three worlds would do, and how they would interact, and then could show how when you have a lot of those worlds, when you go to the continuum limit, you get continuum dynamics that match quantum mechanics. I don't have that. So I don't have the microdynamics for the theory. So this is like hydrodynamics if we didn't know the underlying microphysics. So that's area for future research. Why does this continuum limit work? Why can we talk about things in this continuum if there's only a finite number of worlds? Okay, why finitely many worlds? Why not just accept that there's a continuous infinity of worlds? Some people I've talked to about this project really like that option. So I think, I see that as a variant of the proposal, a sort of continuum variant of the proposal, where you say, no, there really are a continuous infinity of them. I don't like it because I think the story about probability isn't as nice. You can say something like, well, rho is high in certain regions of configuration space, but you can't as easily say the vast majority of worlds are in a certain region of configuration space, because you can't count them as easily. Now, you might not be worried about that. You might. But that's my motivation anyway. That's my key reason, I think, for wanting a finite number of worlds. Okay, how many worlds? Well, you want enough that they can be well modeled as a continuum. How do you tell when it's enough? Well, you'd have to have the underlying microphysics, which I don't have. So I can't give you how many. One way you can start to get a sense of how many is thinking that you need to get the density of the wave function represented pretty well by the distribution of worlds. The amplitude of the wave function represented pretty well by the density of worlds. So you have to have enough worlds that you can get those kind of variations in amplitude corresponding to variations in density of those worlds. So there'd have to be a really, really large number. Good. Okay, so back to this question from earlier. So I said before that you can introduce a wave function to describe the density rho and the velocity fields vk. But as it turns out, you can't always do that. The velocity fields need to satisfy a certain condition for you to be allowed to do that. So there are going to be some collections of densities rho and velocity fields vk such that you can't introduce a wave function. And that's a cost. Good. So what's this condition? Well, if you integrate the momenta of particles along a closed loop in configuration space, you've got to get a multiple of h of Planck's constant. This comes from the intimate relation between the velocities of particles and the phase of the wave function. So if the things don't work out like that, if you loop around and you don't get a multiple of h, then there's not going to be a phase that you can assign to the wave function. You won't be able to assign a well-defined phase to the wave function. OK, so that is all well and good, but it sounds fairly abstract. It might be hard for you to get a picture of when this fails and when it gets met. So here's a case to think about. So think about this orbital of the hydrogen atom. So it's the n equals 2, l equals 1, m equals 1 orbital of the hydrogen atom. What's happening according to Bohmian mechanics in this orbital? Well, if you had a single particle start here, it's just going to orbit the z-axis in a circle. Wherever it starts, actually, it's going to orbit the z-axis in a circle. So all the particles orbit the z-axis in a circle in Newtonian QM. So if we have a collection of worlds now, we ignore all the other particles, so we're just going to focus on the one particle, the one electron, and pretend like it's in an external potential. So all the worlds are just one particle big, and they're all circling the z-axis. So you have a bunch of worlds circling the z-axis. Here's their velocities. They get slower as they get farther away from the center, faster if they're closer to the center. So they're circling around the z-axis. This is the velocity sort of in spherical coordinates, around. And anyway, if the velocity is exactly as it is there, corresponding to that wave function, everything's good. We can represent those particles spinning at those rates, rotating at those rates around the z-axis with a wave function. But if you change their velocity so they're moving 1.5 times as fast or 0.2 times as fast or something like that, then you won't be able to represent them by a wave function. And so that's strange when you look at it from the point of view of Newtonian QM as a fundamental theory. Why couldn't they be going faster, or a little faster, or a little slower? Why is it only integer multiples of the initial speed that are okay? And this is a sort of version of the Bohr-Sommerfeld condition from old quantum theory that sort of pops up again in this theory. Good. And so, you know, how how problematic is this constraint? Well, on the one hand, it's not terribly problematic. We can just introduce it as a constraint. States that don't satisfy it could be called unphysical, or maybe we could tell some story on which they're improbable. Mathematically, it's sort of easy enough to implement. We can just say, yeah, that's a constraint on the allowed states. But I'm still a bit unsatisfied. I'd like to have an explanation as to where that comes from. Good. So summary now, just to go back over pros and cons of Newtonian QM. So, okay, limitations. Yet to be extended to relativistic quantum physics. Everything's been non-relativistic today. Yet to be extended to multiple particles with spin. I have worked on a single particle with spin, and that does work fine, but I haven't thought much about multiple particles with spin. It should be clear that spin's going to be a bit of an issue, because in Bohmian mechanics, spin is often treated as a property of the wave function. If I chuck the wave function, I seem to have chucked all the information about spin. So you should be worried. Don't yet have the fundamental laws. As I'm saying, this is the hydrodynamics. The microphysics isn't around yet. And then there's non-quantum states, states that don't correspond well to a wave function evolving by Schrodinger equation. And there's two ways that we can get these non-quantum states. On the one hand, we can get ones where there's not enough worlds for the hydrodynamic limit to be good. If there's just one world, if there's just a single world, it seems like it's going to obey Newtonian physics. If there's a handful of worlds, I don't know what they're going to do. There's going to be some interaction between them, but I don't know what that interaction between them is, and it's not going to look like quantum mechanics, because there's not enough to describe it as a wave function. There's also states that violate the quantization condition, ones where you can't generate a phase from the distribution of worlds in configuration space. OK, but look at all the cool parts. Yeah. So the first is, the second isn't, for me anyway. I don't know how to write down the state because I don't know the micro, what I'm calling the microphysics. I don't know the interactions between discrete collections of worlds. I can only describe them when there's enough that I can use the hydrodynamic limit. So I don't know what the discrepancies are in the second case. In the first case, yeah, you can calculate things out and see what goes wrong. Good. Okay, so there's still some things that make this a fun theory to study, and I think a good option to have on the table. There are some neat features of this theory. So the first is, right, the wave function we've all gotten used to, but it's a strange thing. And I think it's quite a nice feature of this theory that we're able to explain where it comes from in terms of a pure particle ontology at the basic level. All there are particles, the wave function just summarizes their positions and velocities. That's neat. These particles are never in two places at once. They're never spread out. They follow definite trajectories, so they don't enter superpositions. They interact with each other. They push each other around. But there's no fundamental strange thing called entanglement at the fundamental level. I mean, of course, the same kind of phenomenon will be around, but not at the fundamental level. There's no collapse. The theory is deterministic, so it follows deterministic laws. There's no stochastic element. None of the theories I talked about today mention measurement or observer in the laws. So if one of your goals is to have a quantum theory without observers, which I think is a nice thing, then that's a good feature of all these theories, but one that Newtonian QM shares. The dynamics arise from Newtonian forces. As I was saying, that's the sense in which it's classical. I think that's a really neat feature, as a really interesting feature of the theory, anyway. on Averroian quantum mechanics, you need to tell a story about how worlds emerge as patterns in the wave function and how they separate from each other. Such stories may eventually work, but there are people who don't like them, who think the world couldn't be just wave function. If the world was just wave function, you wouldn't get a multiplicity of worlds. You would just get some sort of failure to generate the kinds of experiences we have of semi-classical world. So the story about how a semi-classical world emerges from a wave function is a challenging part of the Averroian story. And Newtonian QM avoids them because worlds are part of the fundamental ontology. I mean, there are these particles, and the particles are organized into worlds. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a very good question, and I fortunately have a bonus slide for it, so that's good. Good. If you want to get more serious about the ontology, in sort of the way a philosopher might, like what's really going on here with the ontology, there are multiple stories you can tell, and I'm not going to be very committal between them, but I'm going to throw up some options on the table in case you happen to like one. Then you can say that, oh, I'd want it to work that way. Okay, so the first option goes off of David Albert's story about Bohmian mechanics, where he looks at it in terms of a world particle in configuration space. So he says, look, the fundamental space, according to Bohmian mechanics, is configuration space. What is there on configuration space? There's a complex valued field, and there's a single special point, what he calls the world particle. And the world particle gets pushed around by the wave function. As the world particle executes its path, the path is so complicated that that encodes everything that's happening in the world. So there really just is a point in configuration space. If you like that kind of a story, or if you think it can be made to work, points in configuration space move around, then you can have that kind of picture for the theory. So what there is fundamentally is a configuration space. So in this case, I have a picture with two particles in one spatial dimension, what you'd normally call one spatial dimension anyway. The configuration space in this case is two-dimensional, and you could have a bunch of special points in that configuration space, one representing each world. So you can have a collection of special points in configuration space. This is nice because the dynamics are local, so the force is local, which is cool on that version of the theory, but it's weird in other ways. The next option, you can have world particles, but you could say, look, corresponding to each world particle, there is a world with particles arranged in that way. So that's why we have these little arrows here. We say, look, there's a one-dimensional world where the two particles are here and here. There's another one-dimensional world where they're here and here. Those correspond to certain points in configuration space. These are separate one-dimensional worlds in this case, and then there's this two-dimensional configuration space. So we can still have the sort of interactions happening on configuration space, but there's this sort of odd, maybe odd correspondence, and there are these real, in this case, one-dimensional worlds that are separate from it. Another option is to say that there just are a bunch of distinct worlds. The worlds are separate from each other. These laws tell you how they interact, but they're not spatiotemporally connected in any way. That's an option, but you might think it's strange to have sort of causation or pushing around happening between completely spatiotemporally isolated things. So you could put all the worlds on top of each other. I think this is a kind of neat option. If you put all the worlds on top of each other, then you might have a particle here that's part of world number 2, and a particle here that's part of world number 800, and another particle here that's world number 302. And the way particles interact with each other is going to depend on whether they're members of the same world or not. They're not going to interact the same way if they're members of different worlds. So they have this, maybe you could think of it as an additional primitive property. So they have things like charge and mass, and then they also have which world they're a member of. You might want to think about it like that. The neat thing about this option is that all there is in the world, according to this option, are particles in a single three-dimensional space interacting by F equals ma type forces. That's sort of much more than you might have hoped for, and a really interesting theory. In that case, the interactions are going to be very non-local and very strange, but you can do it. So you can have all these worlds on top of each other. For those familiar with some of the literature here, this option is sort of similar to Schrodinger's first quantum theory, is what the some of the Bohmians are calling it, who wrote a paper on that, where you put all the many worlds on top of each other. So you can do that with a mass density ontology, and you get something sort of similar to this. This version here, which might look a little weird, maybe you haven't seen something like that before, it's sort of inspired by Key and Dorr's paper on this stuff. But I see this as sort of, I see this argument, which of these options is best, as sort of working out the metaphysics of the theory. And I don't have real strong feelings about that. I think each one has some virtues, and it may not be that important which one you take. Good. Okay, so back to the virtues. Worlds are fundamental and emergent. Worlds don't branch, so we don't have to tell these weird stories about how one world becomes two worlds, what happens to the people, were there two people all along. This stuff might all be fine, but it's nice to not have to deal with it. As I've talked about, the probability problems are solved, I think. And the last one I should mention in a little more detail, I see this theory as immune to the Everett and denial objection to Bohmian mechanics. So if you look at the versions of Everettian quantum mechanics and Bohmian mechanics on the handout, you should notice a really interesting similarity, which is everything that was there in the Everettian theory is still there in the Bohmian theory. There's still a wave function. The wave function's still obeying the Schrodinger equation. So if you thought the many worlds theory really was a theory in which there were many worlds and agents having experiences in all of them, then you might think that Bohmian mechanics has all that same stuff. So it's also going to be a many-worlds theory. Now it adds things, it adds particles, so maybe there's one more world than there used to be. But it seems like all the things that gave you the many-worlds theory are still there. That's a real challenge for the Bohmian to say why that's why they don't have to deal with that, or why they don't get that happening. This theory still has the problem of being a many-worlds theory, if you think that's a problem, but is not in denial about that. It's forthright about its many-worlds character. So it's at least not subject to that objection. Yeah. Good. Good point. Yeah. So one option that the Bohmian can say is that the wave function can't support life; that you wouldn't have living beings having experiences like ours in the wave function. In doing so, they nicely not only save themselves from the Everett and denial objection, but conclusively refute the many worlds interpretation if it works. So that's cool. On this theory, I have a wave function in the emergent ontology, not at the fundamental level, but at a higher level. And I have collections of worlds interacting. And you might worry that sometimes a interacting collection of world gives rise to different people, more people than you originally had in each world. I don't have a lot to say about that. I've thought about it a little bit. I think it's an interesting question, whether you get people who span worlds. I sort of don't think so, but I don't have a great thing to say there. Good. So let me just sort some of those objections into ones that I think are particularly strong against the many worlds interpretation and ones that I think are particularly strong against Bohmian mechanics. So against the many worlds interpretation, I think these three are key. So first, we don't have to tell the story about the emergence of worlds from the wave function. As was just brought up, that might not succeed. It may be that the wave function cannot support life, in which case many worlds is not viable. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. So I think those are different questions. But you might think that just separating the wave function into these causally isolated parts doesn't show that any of those parts have life in them or would have entities having experiences like us. And that's the problem for many worlds. Good. And then there's the two probability problems, which I spent some time talking about. I think those are really key objections to many worlds interpretation. I think this has a strength there. Good. Okay, now what about against Bohmian mechanics? Well, I think the story about what the wave function is kind of nice, because Bohmians often try to do these dances that the wave function is somehow less real or less not part of the primitive ontology, right, is the technical way they talk about it. On this theory, it's clear in what sense it's less real. It's an emergent entity. It's not part of the fundamental ontology for the theory. Good. The dynamics arise from Newtonian forces. That's cool. I forget why I put that as an advantage. There's no quantitative probability problem. I think that the stories about quantum equilibrium hypothesis ultimately might work, but I do have some concerns about them. I think it's nice to avoid those concerns. And the Everett and denial objection that I was talking about before, I think that's a key point against the Bohmian. So thank you very much. Yeah.
Think about the world. You characterize that as a purely metaphysical, philosophical question. But yeah. I don't know that it is if you think that space-time is dynamical.
Hmm.
In other words, if you start thinking about gravity, it becomes a physical question.
No, that's right. I mean, I was sort of a joking in a way that it's a metaphysical question. I mean, partly because I'm a philosopher here, and so those are questions that I don't think are bad questions. But I think it's a good point that, I think one of the motivations for doing this kind of work, at least that I see as the key motivation for doing this kind of work, is not because quantum mechanics is just so damn interesting and we want to know what it's saying, although I do, but because new theories that combine the descendant of quantum mechanics that's relevant, quantum field theory and general relativity, are hard to come by and hard to make work. And what I think would be useful, from my point of view, or something that I think I could hopefully contribute to that, not that it will necessarily end up helping at all, but you know, a way that you can try to contribute, is to present alternatives about how to understand quantum mechanics. And there may be many of them. There may be more than one that is sort of successful or that sort of looks, for all we know, could be successful. So I think it's good to get as many of these on the table as we can and to see which ones work and which ones have what strengths and which ones have what costs and what they say about the fundamental laws, because it seems like it must be hard, right? It seems like it would sure help in formulating new theories to have precise fundamental laws instead of a sort of roughly stated theory, at least to have some options about what they might be. Those seem like the kind of things that would be really useful to have. And so this theory tries to give some of that. And I think a good point is that, yeah, when we're looking at warping of space-time and GR and stuff like that, these do have very different pictures as to how that would happen and how that would connect to the theory. And that could be an interesting way to decide between them in the end. Thanks. Yeah, that's a good question. I actually haven't worked on that yet, so I'll just be honest about that. But I should. That's a very important question. I think. Yeah, that's all I can say right now.
Right, because just yeah. Because it would come up in
electromagnetism. Yeah. I can say something about this. You can sort of do this all for the single particle Pauli equation with spin, and that has, I think, a velocity-dependent potential if you put in the magnetic field. And that part works fine for single particle. I haven't worked on multi-particles yet. The place I would look, and where I sort of want to look next for extending it to those kind of cases, is Holland's book on Bohmian mechanics. Peter Holland is a good book. And he has an account. So the way he does Bohmian mechanics, he gives particles spin. So let me say a little bit about what I say about spin then, because what Holland does in that account is says, look, we could treat spin as purely a particle of the wave function, like a lot of the Bohmians do nowadays, and that maybe it works fine. But you can also use the wave function and the configuration of particles to give each particle a well-defined magnetic moment, pointing in a direction, not in a superposition, just pointing in a direction. So let me show you what that looks like. So here, going into a Stern-Gerlach experiment, they're all pointing in the same direction. They're all pointing sort of this way. They're pointing more up than down, just a little bit up. What a Stern-Gerlach experiment does on this theory, so you can then have dynamics for that magnetic moment. How does that magnetic moment change orientation as the particle whizzes about and does things? And it turns out that if the particle starts up, on the upper half, in this case, it's going to rotate its spin so it's pointing up. If it starts on the very lower bit, it's going to rotate its spin so it's pointing down. So what Stern-Gerlach experiments do, they don't reveal pre-existing spins exactly. It's not like spin was always quantized. Spin just pointed in a direction. You just had this magnetic moment, and it gets rotated by Stern-Gerlach experiments and other sorts of things. And so you can do all that on a Bohmian story. If you import that into this Newtonian QM framework, I can give each particle in every world a definite magnetic moment. Now I've got my spin information back, which is really nice, because if spin was a property of the wave function, it would all be lost when I got rid of the wave function. So this is a way of keeping that spin information. That, I think, is going to be the key to moving to an account with spin. And for a single particle, I've worked out some of the details there, and it works fine. And you can sort of get the Pauli equation. For multiple particles, Holland has to give a more complicated story. And I've yet to sort of work through how that relates to this approach. But that's what I would look at. Good. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if there's another quantity lurking in the background here that takes into account to convince us that you reproduce the prediction of quantum theory.
Okay.
And this is, as I do experiments and I gain information, I'll end up with a probability distribution for the F over which particular trajectory I think I'm on. And that will be different, of course, from